bunch of panelists on a Monday morning talking about libraries. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program and to our Monday edition of the Roundtable. And it's a great pleasure to be with you this morning. We have a lot to talk about. It was a busy weekend, and there's, as we're just saying, there's just so much stuff. We'll do our best to get through.
It's never ending.
It is never ending, but we'll do our best. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll hear from you. Keep your letters short and to the point. We'll get to as many as we possibly can. And we would greatly appreciate that as always. You learn things every day. And I learned that a comedian is our greatest threat to humanity. This weekend.
A lesbian comedian. Let's be specific here. She's got it all going for her.
This is going over my head.
Oh,
do tell.
Oh. Rosie O'Donnell.
Oh, Rosie, you said comedian. She's not funny.
Oh,
well, she has been.
I think she's a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
She started in stand-up. She had a daily daytime comedy talk show. I would still label her as a comedian.
She's funny. She was great in A League of Our Own.
Yes, an acquired taste that I never acquired.
She's now in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
She's a threat. Has she acquired a nuclear device?
Apparently.
Okay.
It's called her mouth.
It came out of the blue. I thought this one was like an old grudge.
She made a comment about Epstein, and so that's what triggered everything.
Well, it was fun. I thought, well, good. If that's our worst problem, we're in good shape. That's where I was going to get with that whole thing.
But let's be clear with people that Trump threatened to revoke her citizenship.
Oh, here we go again.
Because she was using her First Amendment rights under the Constitution.
Wait, she's in Ireland.
Well, but she's still an American citizen.
You've heard me say this before. I'm going to say it again. What I learned teaching fifth grade, do not reward attention-seeking behavior with attention. That's all I'll have to say.
Even
about
if it's the president of the United States.
That's right.
Seeking to violate the Constitution
of the United
States.
Which, of course, he cannot. So, therefore, thoughtful people would say, well, that's a non-starter. What else is there to discuss?
But why allow someone who is in charge of the country? Why give them a pass when they say things like that?
I'm not giving him a pass. It's just, as citizens, we bring to bear a certain level of sophistication, even when our betters do not.
But the sophistication, what do you mean by that?
Meaning, I'm just going to go into my high school civics teacher rant again. Our political leaders, and it's not unique to this president, it happens on both the right and the left, there's an awful lot in our politics of ready, fire, aim. And I can't speak for my fellow panelists here on the roundtable. I'm overtired of it. I immediately kind of interpret it as unserious and move on.
I'm with you for two out of the three. I don't think it's serious, and I'm tired of it.
But it's politics as entertainment, Joe. Right? It's being driven by the entertainment value.
But I think what Jim says is that there are people who believe that we can, and I'm going to use a word my mom always used in her honor today.
What?
Willy nilly.
the technical phrase,
right,
yeah.
Willy nilly will just say, "Well, you have said this about me, so you're clearly a threat to democracy."
Right.
Whereas you said nice things about me,
and I'm going to give you a big contract.
Yeah.
Okay.
I understand your frustration, Robert. I really do. I'm fascinated that you hadn't heard about it because it was like the story, and it shouldn't have been
over the weekend.
I mean, I agree with you. It shouldn't have been. It absolutely should not have been the story.
I do,
and yet on I would say 90% of mainstream media, it was the main story.
I do remember seeing Rosie O'Donnell as a trending topic on Twitter. And no, I'm not going to call it X, just like I still call it the Triborough Bridge.
What about the Tappan Zee?
That too. Tappan Zee, 59th Street Bridge.
It's all
Pan Am building.
Feeling groovy.
But I was not curious enough to click on the link and find out what it was about.
No, I understand. I understand. All right. Well, actually, none of that had anything to do with what I was going to bring up. What I wanted to bring up was the fact that despite maybe thinking that was the top story, that is not what we're going to discuss this morning, because that was the top story and so many different things, and including, you know, major publications. And so here we go. I want to talk a little bit. Well, let's talk about the State Department. This happened. We talked a bit about the State Department on Friday, and we mentioned that this was after the Supreme Court ruling, and then of course there was a story that we talked about, I think midweek Wednesday or so, about how federal workers were feeling, and then. We got the word that the Trump administration was going to be making major cuts at the State Department. So as this dust has settled a bit, the Trump administration began firing more than 1,000 State Department employees on Friday as it moves to downsize the federal government's diplomatic arm in what critics say is a risky retreat from America's global engagement. The layoffs are part of a reorganization plan devised by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who says his department is too costly, cumbersome, and ideological. Continuing President Trump's drive to slash federal workforce he inherently distrusts, the job cuts will drain the department of expertise and batter the morale of those who remain, according to critics. There were all of these images of longtime employees wearing suits and ties with their boxes of like 8 file folders and a plant.
Wait, I'm not being a smart aleck when I say this, Joe, but I didn't see those pictures. I'll tell you the pictures I saw, again, on Twitter. Young people, shockingly young people. The pictures that I was seeing in my social media of the State Department employees leaving the building, again, I'm not trying to be a smart aleck here, but it looked like, you know, the freshman dorm emptying up at the end of the semester with young people, very young people, leaving and being cheerful and whatnot. And I thought, wow, this is who we're. I realize this is old guy stuff for me, but I kind of expected the suit and tie crowd, you know, the dour intellectual gray hair and gravitas type. It was kids. At least that's what I was seeing.
Well, I do think it's our perspective on as far as kids.
Yes.
You're calling
I think
your
that
older.
Has a lot. A lot. I have a family member who was let go, and you know, I think of them as a kid, but they're 44 years old, and I
I was seeing 20 somethings.
Yeah, but
those are the interns and the college
maybe,
students.
You know, people who had been there for I would say a long time, whose career has ended. Democrats and diplomats also warned on Friday that Mr. Rubio's plan to cut the department's U.S.-based workforce by about 17%, including through about 1,400 layoffs announced on Friday, would leave the department shorthanded, especially after the recent elimination of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, whose relatively few surviving programs will be transferred to the State Department. As the U.S. retreats, our adversaries like the People's Republic of China are expanding their diplomatic reach, making Americans less safe and less prosperous, said a statement signed by the Democratic members of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Jim Ketterer, I will hand this to you with a big bow on top to begin.
Yes, well, thank you. Well, I want to maybe I'll start with the Rubio statement that the State Department is cumbersome, costly, and ideological. So I would agree with the cumbersome part. It's a government agency. I've worked when I worked in government at the National Security Council. Most of the people I worked with had been loaned out from state to the NSC. I worked alongside State Department people for much of my career. And it's a cumbersome government agency. So, yes, it is not costly. In fact, it's a relative blip in the federal budget. And it is not ideological by design. And if there are issues of ideology, then number one, show the evidence. Show the specific evidence. Number two, when there are issues of ideology, there are ways to address that through the current system. And to say, you know, person X, you're a civil servant, you're a foreign service officer, you are behaving in a way that does not align with the ways in which the foreign service and the civil service are supposed to operate, and you're going to pay the price one way or another. And there are examples of that happening. In fact, when someone becomes an American diplomat, they have to sign two forms. One of them agrees to be available for worldwide service, which means just what it says. And people go all over the world, often in harm's way. The second is that you support the policies of the United States government. And the diplomats that I've worked with, and I've worked for three ambassadors, they have worked for Republicans and Democrats. You know, the Foreign Service was set up in 1924 with these specific guidelines. In fact, here on WAMC last year, I did a series of interviews with Ambassador Robert Gassende, who I used to work for. And if people go back and listen to that, if you look it up in the WAMC archives, G-O-S-E-N-D-E, you can hear what a diplomat actually does. And I think part of the problem is maybe we have not done a good job of explaining to people what the State Department does, what the nature of it is, how it is structured, how people are hired through a highly, highly, highly selective process. I would also say it was not just 20-somethings who were let go. I know somebody, for instance, who was let go, who was 15 years in the Foreign Service. I met them when they were a first tour officer in Cairo during the Egyptian Revolution, a very tough time to be there. Also served in Baghdad, served in other places like this, out there on the front lines representing the United States. And there's many, many others like that. Robert Gates, who was a career CIA officer, became the head of the CIA, was the head of the Defense Department, Secretary of Defense, a Republican appointee, no wild-eyed liberal. He pointed out that there simply haven't been enough diplomats over time. The State Department has been underfunded for decades after decades after decades. And he said, you know, the Defense Department has more musicians than the State Department has diplomats. And he wasn't arguing for fewer musicians. He was arguing for more diplomats. General Mattis, a Marine Corps general, no wild-eyed liberal, worked for Donald Trump. He said, you either need to give me more diplomats or buy me more ammunition. And I think that if you look at the places where people were let go from and the bureaus in this quote-unquote plan for reorganization, some of what I have been able to piece together through the people I know, the bureau that deals with countering violent extremism, the bureau gone, the bureau that deals with conflict and stability operations, dealing with the end of messy wars and things like that, gone. The Department of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, on the way out. International Visitor Leadership Program, which is the arm of the State Department that brings people here to experience America directly. Highly valuable program that's existed for decades. Took a heavy hit. The Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, heavy hit. Diplomats in Residence Program that reaches out to our colleges and universities, a long-standing, highly effective program for recruiting and for informing Americans what this State Department does, gone. The Public Diplomacy Branch in New York City, gone. And previous to this riff, the program in the State Department that counters disinformation around the world, gone. And so one can start to see a pattern of this plan. By the way, this is a plan that has not been made public, a plan that has not been gone through with the Congress, a plan that has not had congressional hearings to talk about. Also, the way that these firings were done violates the 1980 Foreign Service Act. There's a lot that's wrong with this. If you want to do a serious reorganization plan, which is not a thing that, I mean, I would say, okay, that's certainly the prerogative of any administration. One can go about that in a systematic way. If you are under the impression, which I would disagree with, but if one is under the impression that the workforce is too large, there is a way within the guidelines of what already exists in the State Department to do a systematic and strategic reduction in force. But what happened on Friday was theater. What happened on Friday was done in a way to send shockwaves across official Washington, which it had. And I would say it doesn't help the State Department. It doesn't help the United States. It doesn't help our diplomatic standing at all. And if it does, I'd love to hear that argument because it seems to be completely absent.
Jim, can I ask?
Sure.
There's something that you said a moment ago, and I have zero experience other than some friends who've been in the Foreign Service. I was fascinated by your point that when you sign up, you take you describe two things.
Correct.
And one is you're committing yourself to the policies of the U.S.
That's correct.
Fine. But surely those policies change over time.
And
we're
you
human beings, right? So if I come in ideologically aligned with one administration, how could I possibly be expected, how would you possibly expect them to remain ideologically as fervent under a new one?
Number one, you're paid to not be fervent. You in your job. That's the job. And if you don't like it, you shouldn't take it.
Well, but
I'm telling you, I've worked with people who have been highly successful in supporting the policies of the United States, no matter who the president is at the time. And, you know, when Jimmy Carter left and Ronald Reagan came in, there were massive changes. But these are serious diplomatic professionals who have been trained to do this. And so it's not just me saying, wouldn't it be nice if people did it? I'm saying I've seen it with my own eyes. People do it. And that do people have their own personal points of view? Of course.
Right.
But when you're on the job, your point of view is not part of that job.
Anecdote is not evidence, as they say. But one photo, when I did not see the Rosie O'Donnell debate, I did see a photograph making the rounds on social media of somebody, one of the outgoing, I assume outgoing employees of the State Department, having put pieces of paper all over the bathrooms in the State Department saying, fight fascism. That's if I'm somebody who worries about the deep state, like, okay, you got one, right? I mean, that's not appropriate.
I'm not defending that, and I can understand why somebody would be deeply angry if they were just fired.
The implication is you view the president or Rubio perhaps as fascists, but you want us to continue to be employed by the State Department?
But so I'm saying that you know you do not engage in political behavior as a Foreign Service officer or as a civil servant working for this U.S. State Department. And that is what makes it difficult, perhaps, but that's what makes it effective diplomacy. And so
I'll defer to you. To me, it says we have a politicization, a problem of political culture in what I agree with you should be a non-political function.
But no, so that one sign, I would say—
anecdote is not evidence.
There's embassies around the world. The State Department, the headquarters in Washington, is just one piece of a global enterprise. And that, that I don't think is—
reflective. Going on for years of changes in administration, and people are taking different keys off keyboards, and
that
and
happened
the
more in the White House, not in the State Department.
Yes, meaning when you lose your job, you're not going to be like
people in the State Department tend not to lose their jobs, and that is the value of it. That's why having career Foreign Service officers that span multiple decades and all of that experience is valuable. When you see in the White House, people come and go depending on the administration.
So I'm looking for a clarification from
you.
Do you feel that because I think you implied something, and I want to see what where you.
Oh, you're gonna hold my words against me?
No, no. Oh God, no! If we did that, we'd all be out of business. It's this idea of, and I'm gonna go back to this well probably too soon, just so you know, but is it like we're gonna get rid of 1,000 people and that be willy nilly? Or is it a deeper project that has been in the works that, as you say, has not gone under any review from Congress, has not gone under any review in the public? We don't know what the plan is. So is it just because they walked in with this plan? They walked into office with this plan.
It was Project 2025. Look, you know, the other part of this is, and you guys can debate this all you want. I really don't care. You're having a good time over there. But when I read all of this, what I saw in my mind were the pillow talk conversations between Trump and Vlad. This plays into Russia's hands. Totally. It totally plays into Russia's hands. It totally plays into China's hands. Not that he's having conversations like that with the leaders of China, but he is with Russia, and he wants to be on Putin's good side, and this plays right into their hands because it weakens our standing in the international community.
I think it helps the Chinese more, actually, than the Russians.
Maybe. Yeah. That may very well be, but he is doing other people's bidding here. Right. By dismantling it. This is part of Project 2025. Well, this is another step towards fascism in this country. This is a way of dismantling democracy around the world.
I just want to answer what Joe said, asked me specifically. So about the willy-nilly versus a specific set of objectives with regard to these firings. So I think both are true. From what I'm hearing from friends at state and people who know who was let go specifically, some of them really are willy-nilly, and it's because they were based in Washington at the time. Foreign Service officers tend to spend about a third of their career in Washington and the other two-thirds in embassies overseas. And so some of them were just kind of easy targets, people with 14, 15, 16 years of distinguished service, but there they were. But I do think, to your point and to Libby's point, that on some of the bureaus and programs that were targeted, these are the kinds of things that the State Department, no matter if it's a Democrat or Republican administration, have gotten all kinds of complaints about over the years from authoritarian regimes around the world, some of whom we deal with very directly. So they don't like the Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Bureau, because that bureau calls them out on violations of human rights. They don't like the Countering Violent Extremism operations, because those are often countering the violent extremist elements of their own governments that are being operationalized. You know, things like the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, that is less that I think is fell into the category of being seen as too woke. The reality is that, you know, many of our colleges and universities depend on those programs. They benefit from them. It's good for the American economy. We bring in many, 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 many hundreds of millions of dollars of international students. I think you can see maybe some patterns and maybe not, but I don't have any evidence of this. That's just piecing it together. I think if there's a plan, let's see the plan. Let's talk about the plan. Let's debate it. In the same way that I think we could have had a very good conversation about USAID, I worked with and for them for many, many years, and they really were crying out for a serious reorganization. Let's have a serious reorganization. Let's be, in Robert's words, let's be serious people. Let's be serious citizens and engage these issues, debate them, and come to a reasonable way forward rather than just say, it's Friday, let's fire 1,200 people.
Right. I've always found the parable of Chesterton's fence to be a useful heuristic. And if you don't know it, it's the one that goes, you know, before you take down a fence, you should know why it was put up to begin with. So, you know, I don't have a firm opinion on this, Jim, to be honest. But I will confess that I'm a little bit skeptical about this idea that everybody in the U.S. State Department is ideologically, if not compliant, or if not congruent, then compliant. You know, that strains my credulity. You know, we all try to be professionals. To your very good point, you know, we do bring our priors to work. In the case of something as strategically critical as the State Department, I look. Who was it said? Elections matter. Elections matter. It's hard for me to imagine that, and I'm not saying they isolated the 1900 or however many, you know, deep state actors. I'm making air quotes when I say deep state, you know, who were you know, throwing sand in the gears. But it's not hard for me to imagine that they exist.
But you know, so Democratic presidents have often criticized the Foreign Service for being too
conservative.
Sure. Republican presidents have, you know, said they're too liberal. It's, I mean, John Kennedy had his problems with the Foreign Service, and he said these are all like Eisenhower plants, and this is a long-standing issue.
But even if that were your goal to get rid of the people who were quote unquote deep state,
the ideologues.
If you use a scattershot approach, is that even is that applicable?
Right. It's not my job to defend here, but is this scattershot? I mean, the article in the New York Times suggested that this was not a Doge enterprise. This was Rubio doing what, you know, he's constitutionally allowed to do, which is run his department.
Yeah, no one is saying this is unconstitutional. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's unwise.
Yes. I think the jury's out, right? We'll find out if it's unwise.
Come on. It is unwise. It's undermining our standing in the world. And if people care about our standing in the world, they will see what this will do to it, right? Not to have functional foreign policy, foreign service, people who dedicate themselves to serving the country, regardless of who the president is. And Jim's absolutely right. You know, they have their own personal politics, but they are there to serve the country and to do what's right from a foreign policy point of view for us, and to keep the United States a player on the world stage. And what this is doing is undermining our credibility as a leader on the world stage. And that's part of the America First isolationist perspective that these people are bringing to our government, plus the whole fallacy of the deep state, which is just a talking point to scare people. The other part of this is that, oh, let's do this over here. People will pay attention to this shiny thing over here, which is their way of doing things in the Trump administration, and not pay attention to the really bad things we're doing over here. ICE is in Albany this morning, okay? So it's coming to our doorsteps.
You know, one of the things that has changed, I think, for the better in the Foreign Service over the last many decades is that for a long time it was seen as a closed shop of Ivy League graduates who went to the right prep schools. And the old phrase is that it was pale, male, and Yale. and that was largely accurate. It has really become much more representative of America. And you want it to look like America because these are people who are out in the world representing America. Mm-hmm. And that has been a great step forward in the Foreign Service. And then, you know, many of the people who were fired were not Foreign Service officers. They were civil service. I just want to say one other thing about the Foreign Service. If you've got somebody who's a bad actor, there is an easy way to get rid of them in the Foreign Service. It's an up or out system. And so if you're not promoted after a certain amount of time, you're out. It's based on the military system. So it's not like you've got people in place that you just can't get rid of.
But you mentioned this earlier about your conversation, which again is available online here, with Ambassador Gassende.
Yes.
And here was a guy who's like this Zelig-like figure for decades, who was a part of every, it seemed like every major operation, and had some input, maybe a little input, maybe a lot of input. But there was a through line, and there was an amount of historic knowledge there that would factor into the conversations and to the decisions that were made. And I worry by doing this type of thing that people like Ambassador Gassende are then cast aside, and we no longer have that institutional knowledge.
Right. And one of the reasons that there is this built-in arc to a Foreign Service career is there's an understanding that this is very complicated work. This is difficult work, and it takes a long time to really learn your craft at the level of somebody who's a legend like Robert Gassende. I would also say Gassende and many others, also the through line is a deep love for the United States and a deep sense of patriotism that inspires one to represent this country, even in places. I mean, Joe, you were talking about his Zelig-like quality. You know, Libya, you know, in the run-up to Gaddafi taking over, Somalia in the 70s, and then back to Somalia during Black Hawk Down, Yeltsin period in Russia, South Africa during apartheid, and then back to South Africa as Mandela took over, Poland during the rise of Solidarity, and working with the Archbishop of Krakow, who would eventually become the Pope. And on, so many other stories. But that through line is a deep commitment to service, and that service is representing this country. I think most Americans, and I can't blame them because I don't think we've done a good job, they have no idea what the State Department does. Unless and until you need a passport or you're arrested overseas, you just don't know. But there's a lot of things that are going on here that I think are valuable to the country. And if there's some that aren't, let's have a conversation, reorganize it, and make sure they're aligned properly.
We're going to have more of that conversation in just a moment. I want to take a break. We have listener letters as well. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. As always, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And anybody else want to comment before we go to listener letters on what we are talking? Okay. You've made it easy for me. Let's go to this letter from Jay. So, a note in a State Department washroom imploring workers to defy fascism is more suspect than a president calling on followers to take part in a riot on January 6th, than a president who is setting up a secret police agency. We're not dealing with a normal presidency now, in case you haven't noticed. We're dealing with a hateful psychopath who, by all indications, wants to toss the working class into chains and concentration camps.
And may I say, Joe, that's not gainsaying my point. That's illustrating my point. If that's your view of this president, then you can't work for that president and be trusted to be dispassionate. Come on.
Well, I don't think this person wants to go work for the State Department, that's not an issue.
They might
What you're saying is that the people in the State Department reflect these views, and we don't know that.
We completely agree with you.
So you can't make these blanket statements of, well, you know, these people don't agree with him, so they shouldn't be working.
Well,
it's just simply not true, and it undermines the credibility and the professionalism of people who have dedicated their lives to our Foreign Service.
I'll tell you what, Libby, while you were having that conversation, while Joe was teaching us about how this works, I had this thought, because I didn't know about these screens that they put in place, Joe. Would you agree or disagree with the idea of rescreening with a new administration? Because here's my guess, is if you did ideological compatibility tests of civil servants, then we'd be having a very different conversation on the roundtable. We'd be calling it a witch hunt, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think if you do essentially, through the promotion process in the Foreign Service, you you have to go through a really rigorous process. It's not just kind of like, okay, it's your turn. Or, I mean, there are panels, there is processes. It's quite rigorous. And so if in the course of that you find out that somebody has been blah, blah, blahing about their personal ideological beliefs while representing the United States, that is the time to say, you know what? You're not a fit for this job.
It's not the blah, blah, blahing I'm concerned about. It's I am diametrically opposed to this administration's view of how foreign policy works.
So what I'm saying is, you know, do you then say like, oh, do you personally have a problem with X, Y, and Z in this new president? Or is there some evidence you are no longer able to live up to the agreement that you signed and that agreement says that you support the policies of the United States? If there's evidence of that, you're going to run into a problem in the promotion panel. And if you don't get promoted, you're out. So the I would say you have to take this on a case-by-case basis and use the system that's in place that has worked for 100 years very well. I mean, I saw somebody in Egypt who spoke out of turn in an official event, not against the United States government, but against the host country government. He was gone in 2 days. Mm. Gone. And so I don't think there's any tolerance for that kind of stuff because it doesn't help anybody else who's in the foreign service. And so, you know, and I'm not saying you're saying this, Robert, but I've heard it from other things. It's easy to kind of, you know, just say, well, generally there's this problem with the civil service or the foreign service or something. I'm just saying, let's live in a world of reality and evidence and facts. And if there's evidence of a particular employee engaging in behavior that is counter to the agreement that they signed, they should be held accountable and things should proceed accordingly. If not, they're living up to the agreement that they signed. They're doing their job. They're doing it well. And they're representing the United States. What's the problem?
All right. Let's go on to other letters from listeners. We welcome you as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Let's see. Having spent an earlier career working in and around the federal government, I can see equivocally most feds have political views. Most leave those at the door or the lunch table, or, you know, whatever. I have never known a career Fed to allow their own views to impact their work. They tend to take their responsibilities very seriously, especially those with legal contract or foreign responsibilities. In both of these cases, I would say that the work is so very complex that without significant training, it is doubtful that Secretary Rubio even fully understands what they do. That is from Kathy. Then we go to this letter. This is on me, and I apologize, and I can't believe I did this. It's one of the few times, I think, in all the years of doing the show that I forgot to introduce the panelists.
Oh.
No, you introduced us.
Did I?
No.
Oh,
no.
Well,
no,
maybe not. Maybe not.
You did it while we were sitting here before.
Yeah,
the show.
No, yeah. That doesn't count. That's not
okay,
the full.
Fine.
You
all
didn't
right.
get your
well, we're
you
all
didn't
here.
Get your full horn blowing.
All right,
this is whole,
blow that horn.
That's
though.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just so people are wondering who are those people
who are
talking?
These people?
And I find that fascinating in two respects. One, that I forgot it, and two, that somebody is calling me out on it. That's good. Senior fellow Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, is with us this morning. He's the one who is arguing about the
ranting on
about the State Department and,
yes.
and the importance of this. Robert Pendicio is the senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, so a different view from Robert, and everybody knows Libby.
Mm-hmm.
Political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post.
And let me also just say, today is Bastille Day.
That's right.
Or La Fête Nationale.
That's right.
And so later we'll be having a panel singing of La Marseillaise And that should really just drive whatever listeners are still left completely away.
Oh, you want me to sing? You don't want me to sing.
Me either.
Well, yeah, let's just have a prison break.
Make all the listeners
we'll have a prison
away.
Break, yeah.
Probably should have done that before I introduced everybody. Susan said, I did several overseas tours with the Foreign Service, and never once did I hear anyone express personal political views. Let's see. Then we go to, Jack says, my husband and I spent 25 years working as diplomats in the Department of State. We served both Republican and Democratic presidents. My husband and I spoke the languages of the country we served in, Russia, Belgium, Hungary. We represented Americana and were proud to show the best of what we had to offer. It was also very much appreciated by the locals. It was hard work. 24/7, we served Americans overseas, our government, and the U.S. What is being done to our organization is incomprehensible. We had great influence in the countries as we dealt with the people of those countries directly day to day and had the in-depth knowledge with what was happening in these countries. What a sad day for our country. Can we ever get smart young people to commit to the welfare of the United States again?
Correct. That's a really good question.
Interesting point on the future of this. Let's see. Jeffrey has a theory on the Rubio and Trump signs that say they're employing fascist techniques. And they say those signs probably exist because they are.
Mm-hmm.
So that is Jeffrey's point of view on that topic. And let me see. This on Rubio. Rubio's comments regarding the State Department are beyond laughable, as if he and the current administration don't have their own ideology. The sheer front of vacuous statements like this are becoming standard. It is beyond disturbing, says David. Then Rich.
Can I just say something about that,
of course,
Joe? Just to maybe make a clarification. So every administration comes in with an ideological perspective. That's how the system works. They are elected members. They are supposed to come in with an ideological perspective, and policy should flow from that. The distinction I think that we're making here is that the people who are implementing that policy, particularly in the Foreign Service and the civil servants, and I would also say the Foreign Service nationals, people of the host countries who work in our embassies, they commit themselves to not being ideological in the course of their work. And so that's the distinction. Just to make that clarification, I think maybe the letter writer may not have understood my comments, which is understandable to not understand them.
Not at all.
Yeah.
They can always listen back. Rich writes, the current estimate is that 64% of our country's voting population actually voted in the 2024 general election. Of that 64%, roughly 50% voted for Donald Trump. If my math is correct, that means only 32% of the voting population voted for Trump. Okay. This is a.
Yeah, no.
All right.
We get into this a lot about it not being a mandate. And, okay. I'm.
Next.
Yeah, exactly. Gina, I mean, it's a point. I understand it, but I think we've made it a lot. So we'll move on. My friend's son, who lost the State Department a job in the recent firings, was 34 years old. He looked like a baby to me. So how old is your guest who opined on the age of a fired employee? He said, it's none of your business. So there you go. We're not going to out him on that. But point made, I think. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We will move on to other topics, and we have much more to discuss. We will do all of that and much more right after this. Morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday. It's the 14th of July, and we thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you here and to have you be a part of our program this morning. We're going to move on to other topics, and we'd like to talk about tariffs. The president had new tariff news over the weekend, so I thought we would talk a little bit about that. And this comes as the European economy, already weakened by an intensifying trade war, faces a new threat after President Trump said on Saturday that he would impose a 30% tariff on goods from the European Union. Economists say the move could worsen the region's struggles in the months ahead. European Union officials meeting in Brussels on Sunday decided to hold off on imposing any countermeasures and continue negotiations in hope of reaching an agreement before the newly announced measures take effect on August 1st. At the same time, we will continue to prepare further countermeasures so we are fully prepared, said the president of the European Commission, telling reporters in Brussels, quote, "We have always been clear that we prefer a negotiated solution." EU economists recently downgraded their growth forecast from the 20-member Eurozone in 2025 to 0.9% from 1.3% predicted in late 2024. The European Commission, the bloc's governing body, blamed the, quote, "impact of increased tariffs and the heightened uncertainty caused by the recent abrupt changes in U.S. trade policy and the unpredictability of the tariffs' final configuration for the lower expectations. A 30% U.S. tariff on European goods would keep EU economic growth stuck around zero," said Bert Koljan, of the chief economist of the Netherlands ING Bank. "Quarters of negative GDP growth cannot be ruled out." So that was one thing. In addition, many countries in Southern Europe are less affected by tariffs because they do not export as much to the United States as their industrial powerhouse neighbors to the north. Robert.
Well, I don't have a lot to add to a conversation about tariffs. I'm not an economist. I'm inherently skeptical of tariffs. You know, anything that raises consumer prices and risks trade wars is bad. What I find fascinating, Joe, I'm looking over our right shoulder. We have a TV here in the studio, and what I've noticed in the past is every time there's a twitch on tariffs, the markets go wild. When I read this last night, I immediately went to CNBC to see what the Dow futures were doing, and they were down 200 points. And I thought, well, that's mild comparison compared to what has happened before. And I'm looking right now and the market's down trivially. I think the Dow is down 27 points. The S&P, I can't see it from here. But that tells me something. It tells me that the markets have either internalized this or don't take it seriously.
Thanks for not outing us in the fact that we have SpongeBob on. Go ahead.
Yeah, really, because I miss him. I think that, this is just another way of Donald currying favor with the man in the Kremlin. But here's what's going to happen, because this is what continues to happen. He puts this out. Local business or United States business cries foul. The Europeans cry foul, rightly so. And then he solves the problem he created, right? He'll be like, okay, we'll just do it at 10%, or we'll bring it down and we'll see what they do, because if they do something, then I'll make it better. But this is his modus operandi. He creates a problem and then he looks like the hero to his base because, oh, I've solved this problem that I've already created.
Libby, that's what we all do in public policy. My job description.
No, I'm sorry. I work in public policy. This is not what we do. I mean, not to this extent. And the people that I work with in public policy in New York want to do what's right for their constituency, not for their own bottom line. And this just helps Trump's bottom line. They have monetized this White House in a way that has created a cushion for him to fall back on that he didn't have before winning the last election.
Subject for another time, but at some point in the roundtable, I would love to have a conversation about those of us, and I'm being sarcastic, obviously, who are invested in the problems that we are paid to solve.
I'm not sure what that means.
Like I said, subject for another time. We could talk about it in education. But you see it a lot, where people who are in the activist and advocate space are profit from the problems that they are not solving. I'm not saying they're not well-intended, et cetera, but there's...
I'm sorry. Yeah. I find that highly insulting.
I'm sorry.
Okay. I really do. Okay. I work in that advocacy space, and I don't create problems that I can then solve.
Come spend a few days in education policy. I'll show you around.
You know, that's not where I am, but I also believe in the effectiveness of public education and public higher education.
Me too.
Can I?
Yes, please.
I just want to mention one thing about the...
Oh, God, please.
One thing?
Sorry, I know I've been ranting a lot. And so I won't rant about this. I just wanted to point out that that in the midst of this talk about tariffs, and particularly focused on tariffs on the Europeans, we also have today the head of NATO is in Washington. Mm-hmm. We have Trump's lead international negotiator, Steve Witkoff, is in Ukraine today, and I think for much of the week. And you have President Trump talking about coming up with a new, highly targeted and pretty intense sanctions against Russia. And so the only way those sanctions would work is doing it in concert with the rest of the Europeans. And so you have all of these other moving parts at the same time that you have these threats about tariffs. And I think the Europeans are wise to say, like, okay, let's not come up with some kind of retaliatory tariffs right now. Let's really focus on the rest of these moving parts, because some of these are extremely important and immediate for Europe.
Anybody else?
Is that short enough, Libby?
Doing just
to the
great.
Point. All right, thank you.
We talked before, and I've used a number of different words. I think the latest was scattershot. But how focused are these tariffs, and where do you think this is going to end for us in the sense of going back and forth? Because as Robert rightly points out, we're at a point now where any number of decisions have been made, and Wall Street just sort of yawns and moves on.
I take my lead from that, not being intellectually lazy, but these are folks whose day job it is to answer exactly that question, Joe. So if the broad reaction from the market is this is a nothing burger, then I take that on faith.
If that's the case, what is the end game with this from the White House perspective? What is the value in doing this? You know, for instance, Joe, you mentioned in the lead in to this topic, the effects that this is having and could have further with the European economies. In what way is that to the benefit of the United States, to weaken European economies? Is there some argument to be made that the U.S. would do better in the international markets if Europe were weak? They're too strong. You know, I would have to be convinced of that. That doesn't make a lot of sense. But and if it's not in the benefit of the United States, and if all this kind of uncertainty, the president saying things that people aren't even taking seriously anymore, to what end? I mean, yeah, really, why is this happening? And why are no people in official positions calling it out?
This president clearly loves tariffs. I don't know why, but it's this is not a surprise. I don't know that, and you know, I have no way of knowing what the thought process is here. I can't play guess what's in Donald Trump's head. But I don't think, or at least I assume, the goal here was not, oh, let's do something to weaken Europe's economy. I think the tariff policy is what it is, right, for good or for ill.
But what they're doing will weaken Europe's economy. Well,
did I mention that I don't like tariffs?
Yeah, no, but
there's a reason I don't
that,
like tariffs.
But you said that you don't know if they did it on purpose, too. I think they did. I think that this is all about him kowtowing to certain elements, kowtowing to the authoritarians that are not necessarily part of this European market, right? And because he wants to be them, he doesn't want to be a democratic leader. And again, creating a problem that will cause Soros for people, you know, and then he'll come in on his ostensibly white horse as the white knight and fix the problem that he created.
Well, I mean, keep in
That's
mind,
what he does
I mean, again,
every
I'm not,
single time.
Not an economist here, but, you know, the left loved tariffs for an awful long time and for the right reasons, right? There's some wisdom politically to protecting American jobs. There's some wisdom to onshoring strategic industries, et cetera. So to the degree that, you know, that kind of tariff policy makes sense, then fine. But this goes beyond that, obviously.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a look at another story before we go to our bottom of the hour break. Again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to this story this morning as we continue on and go to... Kristi Noem defending FEMA response to Texas flooding and says Trump wants agency remade, not cut. So here we go. The Homeland Security Secretary said a report that thousands of calls to disaster to the disaster hotline went unanswered because of staffing that staffing cuts and saying that that was false. That is not true, according to Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, defending the federal government's response to catastrophic flooding in Texas that left more than 120 dead. She dismissed as absolutely false reports that recent policy changes slowed the deployment of critical disaster aid. In an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press, Ms. Noem denied that a new policy requiring her personal approval for contracts larger than $100,000 had left FEMA call centers understaffed for days after floodwaters swept through Texas's hill country on July 4th and 5th. The New York Times reported that on July 6th and 7th, thousands of calls to the agency went unanswered because hundreds of contractors had been fired when their contracts lapsed on July 5th. False news, fake news, false reporting, Ms. Noem said. Experts and current and former FEMA employees have said the agency was slow to deploy response and search and rescue coordination teams, but Ms. Noem insisted that FEMA, which is a part of the Department of Homeland Security, had responded to the Texas flooding better than it had to any other disaster in many, many years, and dismiss claims to the contrary as attacks by the Trump administration's political opponents.
Are we tired yet of politicizing disasters? And I mean on both the right and the left. You know, the right did it during the hurricanes in Carolina, in Hawaii, and the wildfires in California. Now the left is doing it with Texas.
I said this Friday, but I'm tired of it when there are people still missing.
Yeah, well, I mean, and this is not a defense of unanswered calls, but it's also important to be clear on what FEMA does and what FEMA doesn't do. FEMA is not search and rescue. That's, you know, state and local authorities do that. FEMA's role is... they're not a first responder. They guide recovery efforts like rebuilding infrastructure and temporary housing. Those are important things, too. But those are not, you know, the clock is ticking. Someone is missing. So while those, you know, the large number of unanswered calls is obviously a problem, the reporting does not suggest, I guess maybe how could it, what was the nature of those calls and were they emergency calls that should be going to state and local authorities?
Libby Post.
You know, we can make excuses all day long. The fact is that they made these cuts to the National Weather Service. They made cuts to NOAA. And nobody knew that this was happening. The guy that was the one who always made the call was fired. You know, I mean, this is the government's responsibility is to protect its people. And what Trump has done with undermining, A, the credibility of government, and B, the financing of government, is going to result, and I've said this before, in deaths. We saw it in Texas. We also saw children dying of measles in Texas. And now we're seeing measles coming back with virulence because of who's the HHS secretary who says we can't trust experts and doctors. So we have an administration here that really does not care about human life. They care about their own power.
Reason magazine, no fan of this president, looked into the weather claim that was widely made about how cuts in the weather and the National Weather Service resulted in loss of life and dismissed it. Looking at my phone here, their article from
what
a few
magazine?
Days ago, Reason magazine, they're a libertarian magazine.
Well, yes.
Again, no,
that
no,
says it, all.
It does.
Yeah,
they're
it does.
Not. They're not a fan of the president
right.
whatsoever.
Right.
Living.
Okay. But they're also
headline,
not fans of government.
Be that as it may, the Texas floods were a natural disaster, not a policy disaster, was their finding.
Please.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah,
paging Jim Kennedy.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'll stay out of this now.
I think two things. One, the politicization of disasters and the rush to cast blame, particularly as the disaster is still unfolding, is exhausting. I think counterproductive. And I think if we we look at the military, for instance, I think has been very good at setting up a process to do after action reviews and to do it in a systematic and objective way, and I think that's what has to happen here at some point.
You hear.
That having been said, to Libby's point, I think a lot of people, people are busy. They're carrying out their lives, and they don't really have a grasp on what government does, and it's only when something terrible happens
right.
or somebody specifically needs something that is a government function. And if it's not there, then right. then it becomes, obvious, like, oh, this was working along for a long time and I didn't even realize it.
And now it's not.
And now it's not. And so, I've heard Fred Hoff say many, many times in general and on the air that we need to not only do a better job in having people understanding how the government works and civics, but we need to find ways to get people involved at some point, some kind of national service program or something, so they feel like they tangibly are involved at least for a certain point in their lives, and they get that experience up close in some way or another. You know, the devil's in the details, but I like that idea a lot. So I know these are not exactly on point, but I think maybe kind of longer-term ways to think about not just this disaster, but what this says about Americans' lack of understanding in government operations.
When it comes to that understanding of, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of blame focused not only on the national response and on the FEMA response, mm-hmm. but also on the state response and what was done, which I think it begs the question, and maybe not now, maybe down the line, of, okay, but are we putting the states in a good position to handle these issues? Is the federal government giving them what they need to be able to handle disasters like this in the future?
No.
My relationship with FEMA is limited to being the treasurer of the Medusa Volunteer Fire Department. So we view them as a grant maker.
Well, ding, 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 you win.
Well, no.
So I mean, that's their role, right? In other words, you can't anticipate the disaster. You prepare for the disaster. So you make sure that the local first responders have what they need in case, God forbid, they are needed to respond. But the idea, and again, I'm trying to be really careful here and depoliticize this, because I cannot think of the last time there was a FEMA response to a disaster that was not criticized, and by those in the out party, so to speak. It's a little bit unseemly. It's not helpful to anybody. In other words, if your first impulse to this or any disaster is what's the political advantage that I can wring from this, may I humbly suggest your priorities are lacking.
I read an article about this over the weekend, and it made the point, and I don't know if this is true or not, but they were basically saying that it was Hurricane Katrina, post Katrina, mm-hmm. that started that blame game.
That might be right.
And there's certainly mm-hmm. cases yeah. going back to Hurricane Andrew that mm-hmm. that certainly there were times where there were questions that were made. However, when it became a real federal issue as to the bureaucracy and what the agency was doing, that was sort of the start of that.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I mean, I know about this. Alex, our son, was in AmeriCorps.
45 seconds. Go ahead.
In 2005, the AmeriCorps kids were FEMA's response to Katrina. All of them ended up down there. He was 19. He and another 21-year-old were running the Carnival cruise ship that they put all the people on, right? The Brownie, you're doing a great job was not necessarily the right thing to say at that point.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up the show with our guests this morning, and we will include your letters as well. panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable, and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, Jim Ketterer, Robert Pendicio, and Libby Post with us. So if you are a resident of the Greater Capital District or its environs, and you probably know that one of the marquee events in this region is the Saratoga Racecourse, where the best in horse racing takes place throughout many of the summer months. It used to be the August place to be.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
And now you can do it in June.
July. Oh, yeah.
Well, June.
For now.
For the, right. While Belmont is getting all purdy. So I believe this past week, Wednesday, was the opening day of this season. And this will go through Labor Day. And it's a huge deal. It's a huge deal for this community, not only because of the people that it brings in, which is a lot, not only for the economy of Saratoga and the surrounding economy, the money that the state makes, the money that is made, the handle, if you will, that is made is extraordinary. It is one of the most prestigious meets in the country, so as a result, it attracts some of the best horse races, and as a result of that, it brings in more people betting even more money year after year after year. Well, let's zoom out quite a bit and look at just horse racing in general. I want to try to stay focused, at least for the very brief moment that we'll be discussing this, as not so much on the cruelties of horse racing, the concerns over horse racing, and the concerns over the safety of horses, which we have covered in the past, we will cover again, and is not an issue that should be dismissed. But I just don't want to lose sight of the human aspect of this, which is that of who is working at these racetracks and the fact of how much horse racing depends on immigrants and how those immigrants are now really working in fear as a result of this administration and what is being done when it comes to deportation. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids of the second Trump administration and the smartphones with which to view them have halted these laboring lives into eerie immobility after some have logged 10 or 25 or even 40 years of toil on U.S. soil with varying levels of documentation in the horse racing industry. Among immigrants, many workers across the 32 odd states with horse racing confine their existences to track interiors and dorm-like barracks with hot plates and small refrigerators and microwaves and what California Horse Racing Board Vice Chairman Oscar Gonzalez called a perimeter that sadly has become a jail-like experience. I say this with no jocularity whatsoever, but having spent time in stalls in the backstretch of Saratoga, the horses are treated much better than the human beings mm-hmm. who are around them. And I'm not advocating that we take away the comforts for the horses. I'm just simply advocating that we also help the people who are working with those horses. Some refrain from store going altogether or go only at nightfall. Some ask others to run outside errands. Some shop, but in a gasping hurry, nearly all spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the matter. One said each 10-minute walk between the track and their apartment doubles as a 10-minute shutter. Several speak of customary treks from state to state for different horse seasons as recast into rides spent both hushed and unquiet. One tells of one hell of a dilemma. Drive her children from American children for doctor's appointments in fear or refrain from same out of fear. And they look at their phones. They even have things now where they're getting an autorespond if an ICE agent comes, almost like you're doing an earthquake training for you and I or something like that, said Doug O'Neill, a California trainer of two Kentucky Derby winners. Some have adopted a human coping tactic, dark humor. Probably all have studied photos of the June 17 raid at Delta Downs track in Louisiana, a worker handcuffed and face down in the dirt and so on, that detained 84, four with criminal records and two of those four involving aggravated assault or aggravated battery with a dangerous weapon. So the question is, if we're going to keep this up, and especially, I mean, the absurdity of this is that this is the sport of kings and a sport known mm-hmm. to attract the wealthy of this country. And then you look at the other side of this, the backside of the track, if you will. And you will see a very different situation. But these are workers that in some cases have been there for decades dealing with the horses, dealing with the duties of caring for these horses that they do in most cases excellent order. And one other thing I just want to mention, I think most people are probably aware of this, but there is a circuit to this. This mm-hmm. is where you're saying town to town. So once Saratoga would end, typically, then the racing action here in New York would then move to Belmont. Belmont is closed, so now it'll go elsewhere. It can go to New York, and can go to Churchill. It can go to
Monmouth.
Florida,
sure.
Monmouth, and mm-hmm. go to other tracks. Florida runs in the winter. You do still have Aqueduct, and then you bring it back to this region when you start in the spring with Churchill Downs and the Triple Crown races. So
I have a soft spot for horse racing. I should probably not confess this, but my dad often picked me up after lunch in middle school and elementary school, so we'd go to the track in the afternoon. So if I got bad grades in eighth period science, that was my dad. That said, and by the way, Joe was reading from a piece that was in the Washington Post, a big takeout on this issue. Did I miss something here, Joe? Or how did we get to the point? You alluded to it by referring to this as the so-called sport of kings. Very expensive undertaking. Lots of money. You know, millions, if not billions of dollars.
To
train
horses,
them, to house them.
Yes.
So how did we get to the point, and this piece, by the way, was, and we've seen a lot of these pieces lately, deeply sympathetic to folks who are here working, illegal immigrants, to use the phrase. How do we get to the point where this incredibly rich enterprise is being built on the backs of poorly paid illegal immigrants? How did that happen exactly?
I mean...
It's easy. Americans don't want to do those jobs. They don't want to...
My sister does that job. My sister.
The article was really clear that they put out... They try to get Americans to take these jobs, and they don't want them. There are some, sure. But it's the same thing with farming.
That's right.
It's the exact same thing with farming.
You know? Migrant workers and farms and
because Americans don't want to go out into the fields and pick fruit. And they don't want to clean up after horses for the most part.
Because
they don't want
they're
to have
so
to be...
poorly paid.
I don't know if it's because they're so poorly paid. I think it's because we think of ourselves as being above that kind of menial labor.
I'll let my sister
know. I think
a
lot of people think of themselves as being above that kind of labor. You know, we're going to have crops rotting in the fields because of this, because of ice, because not all the crops will be able to be harvested. People are not going to be able to feed their families because of what's going on. And so it's not just, how did we get here? We got here because Americans by and large, don't want to do these jobs.
And Bob, it's a good point, except for the fact that, it's a good point, but it has been going on throughout my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I, like you, grew up at a racetrack. My grandfather was a racing commissioner for the New York State Racing. Ask me why he got the job.
Why did he get the job? Who do you know?
Because he was a good bookie.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So right.
A lot of people knew how to run races, yeah. so they hired the bookies after the war when they tried to make it right because he was the only one who could figure out the odds.
Yeah. Good at math, huh?
So, yes.
Yeah.
But this has been the case as long as I've known, and this article says this, 40, 50, 60 years, this has been the way in farming communities throughout, horse farming communities throughout this country, which, let's face it, a lot of them are in the South. A lot of them are in Kentucky, as well as in California and Florida. So, I think that obviously that has something to do with it as well.
I get it, but there's a moral issue here, right, Joe? In other words, if we're saying, as Libby just did, well, we have to have these poorly paid illegal immigrants here to do these jobs because no American wants them. Well, then, what are we saying about those workers? We're saying it's not good enough for us, but it's good enough for them.
These are people who need to travel because they can't find work in their own countries. They can't do subsistence. They can't survive in their own countries.
So let's just exploit them. Great.
Would you be in favor of the track workers unionizing?
I assume they are.
No, they're not. There's an effort to do it, but it's really difficult.
The paramutual,
the backtrack workers.
Okay, yes.
Okay, yeah, there is an effort to unionize them. But the issue is, part of the issue is, the difficulty in doing that because you have so many different owners, right? And the collective bargaining that would have to happen. But it is gaining traction. Because these people do need to be protected. They need health care.
I mean, I grew up in Saratoga. I worked at the track. I didn't work on the backstretch, but, I mean, you grew up there. It's a small town. Everybody knows everybody, and everybody, you know, you on the backstretch, you see that this is, and Robert, you know this because your sister does this work. This is hard, sometimes dangerous work. But to your point, Robert, well, like, so why has this happened? Why has this gone on for decades and decades? Because we have both political parties who have failed to fix our immigration system in a way that also has a reasonable fix and then finds a way to address these particular industries that are have been highly reliant. Their business model has been highly reliant on people who are massively underpaid and can't really complain about it because of the situation that they're in. So whether it's horse racing, the restaurant industry, senior care industry, agriculture industry, and you know, here in New York State, we have you know, the people who come in to pick the apples. We have the people who are working on the horse in the horse industry, and they're moving around the country all the time. Mm-hmm. And so, a moral question is, you know, why has the political leadership failed to address this in a way that's really going to work? I mean, why couldn't people of goodwill and some good thoughts sit down and sort this out? Part of it is it makes good politics and good business not to fix it.
Also,
there's an incentive not to fix it.
That's right.
Financially and politically.
Right. Libby yelled at me for making that exact point not 20 minutes ago.
The incentive, though, too, of the money can be said on the horses running as well, of the money that's being put into these horses.
Oh, yeah.
Insane amounts of money.
Insane amounts of money who can have their lives destroyed in a matter of seconds.
Oh God.
And yes. At some point, I mean I keep thinking this is gonna happen, but at some point people will realize and I think we saw this when we talked about Santa Anita and other racetracks that were put on pause because they were losing so many lives and horses, that people were gonna say, yeah, maybe we need to take a good hard look at this and this could very well go the way of the circus.
I doubt it, because of the money that's involved and because of the economies. What would happen to Saratoga Springs if the track closed down? I mean, the businesses there make the bulk
parking
of their
would
money.
Be so much better.
Right. You could make a left turn.
but it's true. You
know, we're out of time. I'm sorry,
but that's it's the economics of this.
Yeah. yeah, that 1 week between the horses leaving and the Skidmore students arriving.
Yeah, right.
My thanks to all of you. You're great. We'll be right back.